Hello again, everyone. Bruce Dumont welcoming you to our show for another day. It's nice to have you with us. On today's program, our special guest is Frank Mankiewicz, who was former campaign manager of George McGovern's 1972 presidential campaign, press secretary to Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and author of a new book called The U.S. versus Richard Nixon, The Final Crisis. And Mr. Mankiewicz, it's nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
I said before we began the interview today, I didn't think I would ever want to pick up a book and read about Watergate again. However, I did have a chance to read your book and found it to be very interesting. I think you give an insight into the behind-the-scenes working, behind-the-scenes look at a number of the institutions that a lot of people, perhaps prior to Watergate, took for granted, and it's a very interesting book. I'd like to begin by talking about the role of the special prosecutor and how the special prosecutors, Archibald Cox and Leon Jaworski, were selected.
Well, I think, of course, it's crucial because the point, at least, I'm trying to make in this book, in the paperback, actually, is that once the special prosecutor was selected, Nixon was finished. Once you have a prosecutor with the power of subpoena, then the whole proceeding became a legal one rather than a political one. Prior to that time, Nixon could do all he wanted, and with some success politically. Talk to his friends, support certain policies, carry on certain foreign policy initiatives, all designed to get him a majority on impeachment or conviction.
But, did he know that it was going to be the end when...
Well, he knew all the evidence. I doubt that he knew when he appointed the special prosecutor. I don't think he thought it through that hard. But in retrospect, it's easy to see that once it became a question of merely balancing the evidence, with no public relations impact. In other words, you can't have a public relations campaign in a grand jury. You can't filibuster a trial jury. Sooner or later they're going to weigh the evidence and reach a verdict. The first special prosecutor, I think, was appointed by Elliot Richardson after the firing of Haldeman and Ehrlichman and the forced resignation of Richard Kleindienst. The president had to get a new attorney general, and he appointed Richardson, who had been a very loyal Nixon man and had gone along with just about everything in a number of other jobs. Very pliant fellow. The Senate Judiciary Committee would not confirm Richardson, or indeed anybody else, unless the president agreed to the appointment of a special prosecutor. So Nixon agreed to that and said the Attorney General could appoint a special prosecutor if he wished. I think he did that so that he could fire him, to try to keep the appointment of the special prosecutor away from the White House, so that if the White House wanted to move in on it, they could, or if they wanted to refuse to cooperate. In any event, Richardson appointed Archibald Cox, who, of course, was a distinguished law professor from Harvard, whom Richardson knew. He'd been Solicitor General.
Didn't that really, the selection of Cox, kind of fall into the Nixon plan, though? Because there were a number of things about Cox that Nixon could use to wage a public relations campaign, because he was from Harvard, he was the Eastern establishment, he was a friend of the Kennedys.
He
had a lot of negative things going that Nixon really probably liked to see.
It was
an easy target.
Yeah, it may be that at that point Nixon may have welcomed that, figuring that anything the special prosecutor came up with, Nixon and Pat Buchanan and some of his other hired guns could shoot down. That's quite possible, because I'm not sure he took the thing quite that seriously at that point. I don't think he realized that.
He still thought he was in total control.
I think so. And he also, you know, he knew about the tapes, but nobody else did.
Frank, on that note, we have to pause for a moment, and then we will continue. Bruce Dumont back, continuing now our interview with Frank Mankiewicz, author of The U.S. versus Richard M. Nixon, The Final Crisis. It's now available in paperback by Ballantyne. The price is $1.75, and we were talking about the selection of the special prosecutor. In this particular case, we were talking about Archibald Cox.
Yeah.
Also, one thing that your book points out is that Alexander Haig was very instrumental in the whole behind-the-scenes maneuvering that took place, and specifically in the recommendation to hire Leon Jaworski, who was the next man up.
Yeah, well, there I think was a terrible calamity for the Nixon administration, although I think ultimately, of course, it would have all wound up the same way. But when Archibald Cox was fired, Elliot Richardson then forced to resign, and Ruckelshaus, the White House originally wanted to abolish the office of the special prosecutor, and indeed issued a press release to that effect. But the public outcry and the storm of protest was so great that they just abandoned that idea and saw immediately that they would have to appoint another special prosecutor, and if they didn't, the Senate would. So
wasn't one of the problems there was that they just, again, the press release came out that the office was abolished, that he was fired, and that the attorney general had been relieved, but they didn't really follow through with the with the letter of firing that should have gone out.
They followed through with a letter of firing, but they didn't follow through with an order abolishing the office of the special prosecutor.
Whose mistake was that?
I don't think it was anybody's mistake. I think it was a calculation by Bork. And perhaps Haig, Bork was then the acting attorney general, that if they did that, the Senate and House would come into session the following morning and create the office of a special prosecutor and appoint one, and then they'd really be in trouble. So they abandoned the idea. They were going to turn the investigation over to Henry Peterson, you see, at the Justice Department, which would have been the end of it, because Peterson had indicated at all times that he was quite willing to go along. But they couldn't do it because of the storm of protest in the Senate and the House and in the country. And so they quickly saw, I think, that they had to appoint a special prosecutor who could get by. And that's when Haig found Jaworski. And I think to Haig and to Nixon, Haig certainly because he didn't really know anything about politics, and Nixon because I think he never looked behind the public relations symbols that people demonstrated. If a man was a Southerner,
he had to think a particular way.
He had to think a certain way. If he was, as Jaworski was, a corporate attorney of 40 years standing, representing big companies, oil companies, he had to think a certain way. And as far as Nixon was concerned, that was a good way.
But they were unaware of a relationship that Leon Jaworski had with his late grandson.
You see, Jaworski, in addition, had probably been a Democrat for Nixon, which pleased them. He was from the conservative wing of the Texas Democratic Party, president of the American Bar Association. I guess he looked pretty good to them. But they didn't know, as you say, a couple of things about Jaworski. They didn't know, for example, and they should have known, that he had been a special prosecutor once before at the Nazi war crimes trials in Nuremberg. And they didn't know, as you say, of the relationship with his grandson, which I think, from what Jaworski told me, was a very powerful one.
So you point out in the beginning of the book, you point out that one of the biggest mistakes that Richard Nixon and Alexander Haig made was just a misreading of the entire situation, not only the mood of the American people, but the but some of important intelligence information on Leon Jaworski.
That's right. Jaworski's grandson had been killed in a tragic accident about a year before Jaworski took the appointment. He'd raised the boy sort of as a son. And all through the late 60s and early 70s, they talked about all kinds of things, and the boy had changed Jaworski's ideas about a lot of things, about the legal system and the purpose of the law and the disparities and the injustices in the law. And by the time Jaworski took the job as special prosecutor, I think those things were very much on his mind. And he was not about to throw away a hard-earned reputation at the age of 68 just to help out a president.
One of the most chilling nights in my my memory was the night of the Saturday Night Massacre, when Archibald Cox was fired and the FBI moved in to protect the offices, and the Attorney General had been relieved of command and Mr. Ruckelshaus had been relieved. It was an extremely, to be overdramatic about it and refer to it as a 7 days in May type of situation. I don't think at the time perhaps it was overdramatic, but when you look back on it, I don't think it was. And I think it is one of the most memorable nights in American history, and you really capture it in your book. You really get the importance of the event, what everyone was thinking, what everyone was doing it.
There were a lot of things going on that night. And the curious thing, I guess, was that most people were watching that drama unfold against a background of canned laughter and comedy shows.
The Mary Tyler Moore Show.
People were watching, depending on what part of the country they lived in, Archie Bunker or Mary Tyler Moore or Bob Newhart. and these gay, funny comedies, and suddenly they'd be interrupted, and there'd be some breathless network news correspondent on the White House lawn telling us some new horror. President sent FBI agents to take over the office of the Attorney General or the Special Prosecutor, or this person had been fired or that one had resigned. And then they'd go back to this, to these comedies. It was almost surrealistic.
Frank, we have to pause here for a moment, and then we will continue. Our guest is Frank Mankiewicz, author of U.S. versus Richard M. Nixon, The Final Crisis, former press secretary to Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and manager of the George McGovern campaign in 1972. And we'll continue in a moment. Hello again, everyone. For those along the network line who have just joined us, it's nice to have you with us today. On our program, we are talking with Frank Mankiewicz, who is author of U.S. versus Richard M. Nixon, The Final Crisis, former press secretary to Robert F. Kennedy, and manager of the 1972 campaign of Senator George McGovern. We were talking about the Saturday Night Massacre and the special prosecutor in the Watergate era. One thing that that you talk about in the book is that Richard Nixon had plans to get Spiro Agnew and get Cox well in advance of the time that actually happened.
Well, Elliot Richardson has said that that while they were discussing the Agnew problem, the president said to him, and as soon as we get through with that, then we'll get Cox. Now, that was back in September. So it's clear that whatever the president's reasons for firing Archibald Cox, they weren't immediate. He probably sensed early on that Cox was getting into areas that would eventually cause him a lot of grief.
Do you feel that the decision to go ahead and get Agnew was made by the President of the United States exclusively to get the heat off himself and perhaps to bring to the American people a feeling of disgust that they would force their congressman and to drop pressure and to get the press off his own back?
No, I think the Agnew situation, I think once it had been developed by the U.S. attorneys, obviously had to be dealt with. Too many people knew about it. In the middle of the Watergate cover-up, there couldn't be an additional cover-up. It simply couldn't have been done because nobody was that loyal to Spiro Agnew. I mean, evidence was there.
Did that investigation start in Maryland and go to Washington, or did the order come from Washington?
No, it started in Maryland. I assume. I've never seen any evidence that Nixon knew
personally
about Agnew
directed earlier.
But once people knew about it in Maryland, then the president had to make a decision. And the question was whether to indict Agnew and force his resignation or to let the matter go to impeachment. And there, you see, Nixon had a terrible problem because it was obvious that Agnew would have been impeached. I mean, it was a straight case of extortion and bribery, and the evidence was overwhelming. I don't think he wanted an impeachment proceeding going through the House and Senate at that time because it would have showed them how to use the machinery. It would have showed the people in the House and Senate how easy it was. So it was important. And at that time, I think the president did take charge and, in effect, work the Agnew situation out so that he had to resign rather than string it out with a long impeachment proceeding.
As you look back on that period and as you look back on the last 25 years, you have been on opposite sides of the political battles with Richard Nixon for a long, long time. Does it give you any satisfaction that you've been right all this time? Do you gloat at times and say, I told you he was a bad guy?
Yeah. I would have to be less than honest if I didn't admit that. I think that's always an element. I think you know, a politician who takes credit for the rain is going to have to be blamed for the drought. You know, a lot of us talked a long time about Richard Nixon, and I think I think there is a certain element of pleasure, even at least of personal pleasure, in the fact that it all became public knowledge. But that's not really what pleases me. I think what really pleases me more than anything else in this, and I think I speak for other people as well, and I tried to say it in the book, is that the American political system really worked pretty well in all of this, or at least the legal and judicial system did. When you think about it, Here we removed from office President of the United States, who has got to be the most powerful leader in the history of the world, whatever his party or whoever he is. But for some time now, the President of the United States is quite something. He was removed from office against his will before the end of his term, and we did that without violence. We did it without passing any new laws and without any damage to any of our constitutional structures. Well, there are not very many countries in the world where that can happen. I mean, you read somewhere that a head of state has been removed from power, and the chances are it's by violence or by a change in the form of government. So I think we can all take some pleasure from that, that the constitutional structures that the founding fathers laid down 200 years ago turned out to be pretty sound. They work.
In looking at what Richard Nixon did and what Richard Nixon allowed to happen, mm-hmm. do you think that perhaps there is some degree that Richard Nixon, although he tried to subvert the system, that in his heart he also believed in the system because he allowed these things to happen? And is it not conceivable that that someone perhaps who thought less about the system than Richard Nixon yeah. might have tried to move ahead with a military coup during that period?
Well, no, I don't think so. I guess every criminal believes that he's innocent, and if he's not innocent, that at least that he's doing the right thing. I don't think Richard Nixon ever said, well, I see this political system that the U.S. has, and I understand it, and I want to change it. I want to subvert it. I think he just never understood it. To him, the notion of a free press was always offensive. After all, you're talking about a man who, in one case, tampered with evidence, and in another, encouraged tampering with evidence, who was willing to use institutions of government to block an investigation of a crime, and a fairly serious one, who thought that the purpose of the Internal Revenue Service was to harass political enemies, and that its laws, as far as requiring the payment of taxes, didn't apply to him. No, I think he simply...
Then why didn't he try for a military takeover? Have you ever heard a story from anyone who was connected with Nixon at that particular time that perhaps he did think about that?
No. Secretary of Defense Schlesinger, however, in the 4 or 5 days before Nixon did resign, thought enough about it to send word to the chiefs of staff, to the heads of all the military services, telling them not to obey any orders from the president for troop movements without checking with him, so that some people were thinking about it. But I don't know. That's a hard... I don't think his contempt for the system extends.